All right, we need to make one announcement before we begin with our first case. Justice Walker.
Thank you. If the lawyers in the second case, cause number 02080383, RSI, and Essex Insurance Company versus CTC, if y'all could step to the bench for a minute, I need to make an announcement to you guys on the record. I just wanted you both to know that one of my dear friends of 23 years is an employee of RSI. She works as an assistant for one of the underwriters at RSI. She has worked there approximately 5 years. And it's my belief that this friendship would not cause me to be partial in this appeal. However, I wanted to disclose these facts to both of you all and give you the opportunity to assert a recusal if you so desired. So what we will do is we'll take about a 10-minute break after this first case and give you all the opportunity to make whatever calls you need to make or talk to whoever you need to speak with. Another judge on our court is standing by and is prepared to step in the event that that's the course that you choose to take. And so after we take our 10-minute break after submission of the first case, if you would just notify Ms. Spezak of your decision on that matter, then we will proceed accordingly. Okay? Thank you so much.
All right. We will proceed with the first case on our docket, Hideway, Inc. and Charles Glenn Hyde versus John R. Davis. Ms. Spezak, if you'll please announce counsel for that case. All right, Mr. Trantham.
Good afternoon. I'm told by your clerk that we don't do this very often in the afternoons, but I can tell you the parking's a lot easier, and I think the lawyers would appreciate you doing that. This is kind of an interesting case, factually, as well as legally, my experience. The case involves a privately owned airport out here across from Texas Motor Speedway up in Denton County. Hideway Incorporated is a corporation. It's basically a construction company. Glenn, I'm sort of in an awkward position of arguing for my co-counsel's client, too, at the same time. So Glenn Hyde is an individual. The airport is formerly called Aerial Valley, by the way. It's founded by Edna Gardner White, who was one of the first women to solo on an airplane. And I met Miss White. She was in her 80s, and she was in the OX-5 club. And I know, unless you're a pilot, you don't want to. The OX-5 was a surplus motor from World War I, and they put them in all kinds of planes. The people that learned to fly it with this OX-5 motor became the OX-5 club, and they're all passed on now. But it was an interesting history. This airport is, again, is privately owned, and portions of it have been sold, hangars and stuff, to private individuals, of which the John R. Davis is a man who bought one of these hangars. Okay, now the airport itself is, I believe, is a corporation, as I recall. But anyway, the airport, getting to it requires you to go over right away that's owned by the airport. You buy your plot, and then you have the access to the airport. And over the years, there have been disputes about whether or not you have to pay a fee to cross over to get over to the runway and take off and land and come back and all. And this comes from one of those disputes. The testimony, you can read the testimony. It's kind of interesting. There's large amounts of dirt piled out into the taxiway to prevent Mr. Davis aircraft from coming out because of the dispute they had, whether or not they had to pay fees and stuff. And Mr. Davis' access was ultimately limited to a passage through kind of a creek area. This has been going on for some years. They're both asserting they have rights, and litigation has gone back and forth. Well, at any rate, on one particular afternoon, don't know whether it was hot and sunny or cold and wet, doesn't really matter. Mr. Glenn Hyde is driving his pickup truck when he sees John Davis. And I believe the undisputed evidence was that Mr. Davis shouts something like, "You got something to say to me?" And immediately they jump out, or Mr. Glenn jumps out of his car, a truck, and goes over and proceeds to strike John Davis, knocking a tooth out. That's how this litigation got started. So it's kind of an interesting background there. And then the case gets real interesting, very strange. We have appealed it on the basis of virtually no evidence, not even scintilla on a lot of it. But the thing that makes this a very great curiosity to me is question number six, that we've objected to it in its entirety. But to give you some idea how strange this thing is, if you read question six and you read C and D, are the answers. Now, the questions were loss of earning capacity. All right. Now, when we get down to the judgment of the court, you'll find that is attached to Exhibit 4. Question 6, C, according to the court's judgment, was past lost wages. C was past lost wages, and D was future lost wages. But the questions, which you can see easily on Exhibit 1, was loss of earning capacity. And we objected that there was no evidence of earning capacity, lost or past, ever presented. And suddenly when the judgment gets written, it metamorphosized into lost wages. But no instruction was ever asked about lost wages. And so I think we ought to be sustained on that. Sure looks like to me there's no evidence to support what the jury was asked. And suddenly it's out of the blue, and I guess, I don't know, miracle of writing judgments, it became missing wages. So that's what's really fundamentally wrong with this whole case. We get into this also, the malice issue. And I don't doubt that Mr. Hyde, in kind of a childish act, temper, struck John Davis. I don't think there's any question. But is it really malice? Did he plan it? Did he intend to do all this stuff? Or was it just a sudden burst of temper? And there's no evidence that there was anything more than just a sudden burst of temper. Two guys, one says something that's, we don't have fighting words in Texas anymore, but it's provocative to say the least. So we have that in there. And we get into some other things. You can read each one of these. There is kind of a hint that Hideway, for instance, we were asked about whether or not Glenn Hyde personally was an employee. Now, he was a director and president at one point, owned some stock at one point, sold that out, didn't own his stock, but was still one of the corporate officers. But there's absolutely no evidence that he was an employee, and we've cited that. How could he be an employee if he's not employed? That was to start with. Secondly, we've also objected there's no evidence that he was on the Hideway Incorporated's nickel, so to speak, working. There's no evidence of it. He's an officer of Hideway. He was out there, so that's kind of enough to sue Hideway. And we objected on that evidence, total lack of evidence that he's an employee, but evidence that he was an officer, but that's never been asked the jury. Did he do it as an officer? It was always as an employee, and so we objected to that. And we got the charge. We get down to this medical expenses. And that really gets to be fun. That's 6E, okay? Now, where that, in my opinion, is so strange. Mr. Glenn Hyde was convicted of simple assault in this case, criminal case, and after hearing, ordered to pay the medical expenses that were incurred by Mr. Davis. That seems simple enough to me. Between the jurisdiction of the court, they had a hearing, they determined what it was. He paid it. And it's testimony, he paid it, no question. But when we got trying the civil case, okay, You'll find in the transcript a huge amount of discussion about whether or not this is a collateral payment. And the collateral source rule, which was intended for insurance purposes, where, you know, you can go out and anything can be done by contract. I can contract with 50 people to pay me whatever that damage was without regard to anybody else, that kind of thing. And we got off this collateral damage or collateral source stuff. And if you'll take a look in the transcript, the judge says, well, it's a double recovery. I'm going to allow him a double recovery. And it's very clear. It took about 2 minutes writing the brief to suddenly run into the case and say you can't do that. And it's basically based on due process in the Constitution that you're seeking double payments. So that's where we are with that. Then we got to the issue of physical pain and mental anguish.
Counsel, before you go on, though, I think the appellee's complaint was that there was really no proof submitted in the trial court as to the amount that was received in the criminal case.
We were prevented from that testimony, although it's in there, and I can, if I've got it, I can dig through it and find it. It was in evidence, but it was not. It was done how much he paid as a result, and I believe the judgment of conviction was put into the evidence too.
Okay.
And that was a reimbursement for medical expenses, and that wound up as a document itself into evidence.
Thank you.
Now, and Mr. Baumgartner, I learned a lot from him in this trial, I have to tell you that. An old lawyer, can teach a young guy like me. But we got into these issues of the physical pain and mental anguish. And there's some talk, you know, there's talk, but none about value or where it came from and stuff like that. So we think question six on damages was entirely inappropriate to give, and the answers obviously have been changed in the judgment to reflect what wages and stuff. So we think that those are, at least should be reversed, and the double payment should also be reversed at a very minimum. The medical care expenses are just where that came from. I have no earthly idea, and there's no really more testimony than kind of a, well, it could be. You know, just what it could be. It's just kind of a hit and miss. I really think that this case is about as close to not having any evidence as I'm saying. But it's not quite there. We know that there was a Glenn Hyde, and we know there was a Hideway Incorporated. So there's something out there for those two. But as far as employee, no. As far as on the Hideway business, no. And when we get down to the exemplary damages, there's no proof was offered. I mean, it was, you know, just kind of a scientific idea that maybe, you know, we had some form of malice. Obviously, he intended to hit the guy, but that's not malice, as I understand it, for punitive damages.
Mr. Trantham.
Yes.
The plaintiff's allegations are that this confrontation, exchange, whatever happened that resulted in the simple assault occurred mm-hmm. in the front yard of the plaintiff's residence. Is that accurate?
Oh. Okay. You have an airport, and you have a road, and you have a bar ditch, and I suspect that it was probably in his yard, okay?
All right, now
but, I mean, I don't believe it's a fenced in area.
Are you familiar with Exhibit 27 that's been cited and discussed in both briefs? It's a letter dated December 12th, 2002, and it's
by
got
Glenn
a map
Hyde?
Attached to it.
I'm sorry?
It's got a map attached to it, that Exhibit 27.
Yes.
And I'm asking if the altercation, or whatever you want to call this event, took place on the premises where the there's three metal buildings that are shown to be owned by Mr. Davis. Is that where this happened?
I think it started in the bar ditch, and I'm not sure if the bar ditch is on his property. I've seen the map.
Okay.
I've seen it physically.
But this is at
But it started, but I'm sure it ended on his property.
But it's at the airport area. It's not at some location away and apart from the airport.
No, no. This is, there's residential places. I'm not a pilot. I do not understand why anybody would want to own a house on an airport. But they do.
Okay. Well, then let me
and
ask
so
you
that's,
the second.
But that's not a,
I'm
no.
understanding you. The second question is, in terms of the airport, your brief indicates that the airport is owned by Texas Air Classics.
Was yes.
evidence put in that the title to the airport is in Texas Air Classics?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
And that's the corporation that owns the airport itself. Hideaway is a construction company, not the owner of the airport.
I understand.
Yep.
Thank you.
I notice I'm on the yellow light. That means get out of here, I think.
No, you have probably about a minute left.
Well, let me give you some change and get Mr. Kelsey up here. I'm sure he'll do a good job. We've known each other many years.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kelsey.
Thank you. I represent Dusty Davis, who is the injured party and the plaintiff and the appellee in this case. I think there are some issues that we need to look at from the very beginning, and procedure is important. Procedure in the trial court is important. Procedure in the appellate court is important. That's the way we do what we do. And I think it's important to notice in this case, as I said in my brief, that they filed only a general denial. They have no affirmative pleadings of any kind whatsoever of anything else. They made no objection at the time the jury charge was put together, other than no evidence and, in a couple of cases, no pleading. But then when they assigned their error in this court, they did not assign the no pleading as a basis for error in this court. Now, what's happened is they briefed issues they never presented, and now they're arguing issues they're never presented, and this is discussed extensively in our brief. Perhaps the most serious issue that of what they've done is the collateral, what they call the collateral source rule, which is really the one satisfaction rule. That's actually what they're arguing. But the problem with it is one satisfaction rule has a basis that says if multiple defendants and one person settles or makes a payment or whatever, and there is a single indivisible injury, then that amount can be credited by the other parties if they want to toward the total recovery. Now, that's the one satisfaction rule. That's not quite what we have here, because what the appellant is saying is, I paid money. Now, he never testified. He never proved up anything. He never proved what it was that he paid for. He just says, I paid. Now, he's telling that in to this court, but there is no evidence of that anywhere in the record that he paid anything. There is a monetary amount set forth in the criminal judgment, which is a record. But there's no indication as to what that was for. It's just a monetary amount. Now, this court has looked at that question before. Actually, Justice Gardner wrote the opinion in Toshiba versus SPM, which I did not have in my brief, but I'm happy to give it to the court now. It's 183rd. 761 at 780. It's a Fort Worth case. And it talks about the double recovery rule, because you can't fuzz the double recovery rule with the one satisfaction rule with the collateral source rule. Those are all slightly different things. And what happened in what Justice Garner said in this opinion was that you have to take a detailed analysis under the evidence to determine whether there's a double recovery or not. It isn't just good enough to say that. There was no pleading for a payment. There was no pleading for offset. And this court also held, Justice Walker wrote the opinion, in Columbia Medical versus Bush, that Rule 94 applies on offset cases, and if you're going to offset, you have to plead offset under Rule 94. There was never anything but a general denial. They made no objections at the time the charge was put together, requested no definitions, and Rule 278 says if you're going to object to a definition or if you think it's not legally adequate, Sure, you can object, but if you think it's a matter of definition, you have to submit a properly requested definition. That was not done. There was no effort whatsoever to do it. Now, I want to talk about some of the cases. On the question as to whether or not the wording of the petition and the wording of the jury question, if you look at Section 41.001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which is the definitions under punitive damages section, or damages generally, it says under subpart Prince 10 in the definitions of 41.001, quote, future loss of earnings includes, Prince A, loss of income, wages, or earning capacity. It's all the same thing. So the pleading is certainly adequate to give them notice as to what was going to be submitted to the jury. They did not object to the definition. They did not request a definition. It's perfectly adequate to cover that issue. Now, the evidentiary elements that were required by law for punitive damages were properly submitted and properly answered by the jury in favor of the appellee. I think it's important for me to try to go over their questions quickly. They assigned as error that there's no evidence to jury question number one, and that is whether Hideaway was responsible for Hyde. It's kind of a little unusual because usually we see it the other way around. We usually see whether the corporation's responsible or for the acts of the corporation as opposed to the acts of the individual. Now, this is covered in our brief extensively because what happened is that the proof in the case was Hideaway runs the airport. He is self-identified as the enforcer. He is self-identified as the person who does everything on that airport, regardless of which corporation he's calling himself identified with. As a matter of fact, testimony, one of them is he is all those corporations. Question number two, no evidence that Hyde was an employee. Now, I briefed this extensively, and I've even quoted directly from the cases. The word employee is not an exact legal term. It is different than master and servant. It's different than principal and agent. It is a combination of a number of different things. So in order to know what an employee is or is not, you have to get into the facts of what it is that they do and how they do it and how it's supervised and how it's structured. And in this case, the proof was, unquestionably, that Glenn Hyde was president of Hideaway. Every act that was done by Hideaway was done through Glenn Hyde, every single act. And the only thing that Candace Hyde did, that's the wife, the only thing that she did was secretary and treasurer. But if you look at the letter, and that letter, as Justice Meyer pointed out, is extremely important. It is written on Hideaway letterhead, purportedly for the business of Hyde, signed by Glenn Hyde, typed by Candace Hyde, as the evidence shows. And it presents the issue of, look here, I'm representing Hideaway, and this assault took place, and incidentally, the evidence, Judge Meyer, is that the whole letter is false. If you look at the evidence adduced at trial, the letter is in fact false. And the testimony in the record was the assault took place in the front yard. So that's mm-hmm. He was out mowing his lawn. So everything that Glenn Hyde submitted was false.
But under your theory, then, you could never have a corporation that was a closely held corporation with only one shareholder and one officer and one employee?
No, Your Honor, because you could do that. But if you look at the 21 point, which is argued in their brief, incidentally, 21.223 of the Business Occupations Code is limited to contractual matters, not tort. The actual language says, quote, if the beneficial owner caused the corporation to be used for the purpose of perpetrating an actual fraud, but it is not applicable to torts by its own words. So that if there is a tort committed by a vice principal or an agent of the corporation, we're into tort law. We're not under that statute in any way. Because it says on subpart A2, the contractual obligation of the corporation. So in answer to your question, that statute and that rule of law simply doesn't apply to torts. Have I answered that sufficiently?
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Kelsey.
Sir.
Is it your understanding that the airport was owned by this separate corporation?
I think it was owned by one of the corporations. The testimony that I recall was it was purchased by Hideaway, Inc., and it may have been transferred after that.
Well, on December, whatever that August date was in 02, is it your understanding that the airport was not owned by Hideaway, Inc.?
I've got the record. I would have to look at that. My understanding is that there was testimony that it was owned by another entity. I'm not sure. I don't remember whether the name was identified.
Well, what evidence was there concerning the contractual relationship, if any, between the owner of the airport and Hideaway, Inc. as to the responsibilities of Hideaway, Inc.?
Well, the only thing is the deed restrictions and the covenants and the conditions, which we pointed out are one of the sources that Mr. Hyde complained about all the time.
Well, but those would deal with the owner's rights to enforce restrictions on the use of the property, wouldn't it?
It would. It would depend upon what the actual wording of the restrictions, but that would be generally true.
And then how would Hideaway, Inc. fit into any involvement except by contractual relationship with the owner?
Well,
in terms of involving enforcement or any other activity at the airport by Mr. Hyde, what evidence was there about his involvement with the company that actually owned the corporation, owned the airport?
Well, there's one statement in the record that I know precisely because I quoted it in the brief, and that is that all the corporations are Glenn Hyde, and Glenn Hyde is all the corporations.
And is that the source of the evidence, that is evidence sufficient to show a connection between Hideaway, Inc. and the Texas Air Classics?
I would not think so, sir.
Okay. You mentioned that the statements in the letter of Plaintiff's Exhibit 27, you mentioned those were all false statements. You said in your brief that you relied upon that letter and indicated that the letter by itself is sufficient to support the jury's finding in answer to question number one. Is it false or is it sufficient?
I don't think those are necessarily exclusive, Your Honor. I think that the letter speaks for itself. It's written on Hyde letterway. It talks about the assault that took place. It talks about he was trying to protect Hideaway property is the only thing I can assume. I don't know why else he would have written this on Hideaway letterhead if it were not to protect Hideaway property, which is what he says here implies in the letter.
Thank you, sir. You say that he characterizes himself in the letter as the protector of Hideaway property. What language in the letter were you talking about when you said that?
Well, let me find. I'll have got the letter here. I'm sorry, this is going to take a little bit of time to read it. Please advise Mr. Davis not to come on my property as soon as possible. I've enclosed an airport map showing Mr. Davis's property and the airport property. He owns a metal building near the airport. I've advised Mr. Davis to stay off my airport property. That's the language that I'm assuming means airport property. He's referring to it as my airport.
Was there any evidence that Hideaway, Inc. owned any other portions of the property, not the runway, not the facilities where there was gasoline or the office?
There was evidence that Hideaway bought the entire airport. I'm not sure what they retained. If I remember the testimony right, and I can supplement this if you'd like, there was a testimony that the airport facility was transferred to Texas Air Classics, but this is the residential area.
Thank you, sir.
I'm about to run out of time. The only thing that they've presented at trial to the trial judge or to this court is a no evidence issue. I think their brief does not properly close on that issue. I think if you're going to argue no evidence, you can't just say no evidence and throw it at the appellate court and make them pursue the burden of gleaning the record. I think it's the job of the appellant to to say this is where this was discussed, this is where it was discussed, this is what was said. You'll notice that there's no evidence that supports that. That was not done. We've gone through this entire record. We have documented everything that we have said in the record and sent the court and the briefing clerks to the specific line, the specific page, and the matters that we've quoted. We think there is plenty of evidence to support this entire verdict and plenty of evidence to support the award of the damages. They are within the statutory limits, and we think that the judgment should be affirmed. Answer any questions the court may have.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kelsey. All right, Mr. Baumgartner.
It pleases the court and counsel. Justice Meyer, the answer to your first question is no. If you look at the jury charge, which is number one on the appendix, question number five, you'll find that did all or part of the assault take place on John R. Davis's property? Answer, no. There is ample evidence in this record that Texas Classics owned this airport lock, stock, and barrel, and counsel suggesting that you have to prove the negative is impossible. If there is no evidence, there is no evidence. In this case, you start out with the proposition that somehow, some way, you can come in and reverse what has traditionally been the Texas, how you pierce the corporate veil routine, and reverse it. And by golly, you're there. Well, you don't get to reverse it. You know, if there is some relationship between Hideaway Inc. and Hyde, it's up to them to prove. The only thing they ever got from anybody, and it is outlined in our brief, is a bunch of gobbledygook. Mr. Davis ultimately testifies, well, he's everybody. Well, what does that mean? Absolutely nothing. It is not evidence upon which the plaintiff can rely and should not have relied. Furthermore, I've tried a few cases in different counties here, and I'm not sure that I didn't get the best hometown job I've ever had. You have a question submitted to the jury as to earning capacity. That's a legitimate question. What is his loss of earning capacity? How do you prove it up? You prove it up with a doctor who says, in all reasonable medical probability, this man has lost 10%, 15%, 20% of his earning capacity. There is zero evidence to support any dollar sum for any earning capacity, past, present, or future. And then you come down to it, and while the jury questions are propounded with regard to capacity, I'll be dadgum if the judgment, which is Exhibit 4 in our appendix, mysteriously changes form and morphs into the simple fact that this is now wages. And you can look at that at page 2 of the judgment under damages, where C becomes past lost wages, not earning capacity. D becomes future lost wages, not earning capacity. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no basis, there is no evidence to support these claims, and Texas Classic might have been a proper defendant here, but Hideaway has got no basis being the named defendant and grouped into a reverse pierce the corporate veil. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Baumgartner. All right, gentlemen, your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. We will now take a 10-minute recess. And after you finish your discussions, if you'll let Ms. Spisak know something. And then we'll pick up with case number 2.